Well, hardly a program goes by here on Coast to Coast where somebody, some guest, doesn't bring up the name of Dr. Brian Weiss. And he is our guest tonight as we talk about his latest work, Miracles Happen. And we're going to get right into that on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Dr. Brian Weiss with us, of course, the nation's foremost expert on past life regression therapy. He's a graduate of Columbia University and the Yale Medical School as well. He maintains a private practice in Miami. His book, Miracles Happen, co-wrote with his daughter, Amy. And here is Dr. Brian Weiss back on Coast to Coast. Hello, Brian.
Hello, George. Good to be back with you again.
Hey, by the way, your daughter went to Washington University in St. Louis.
Yes.
Where my place there, probably about half a mile from that university. It's a great school.
Yes, a fabulous school.
And, you know, so many students have gone into all walks of life after that. I bet she enjoyed that.
She did. And it also has a great medical school, lots of fabulous graduate students there in St. Louis, a wonderful place.
Sure is. I'm back in L.A. But, you know, you're a medical doctor, first and foremost, and you concentrated on past life regression therapy. How did that all start for you?
Well, as you mentioned, I went to Columbia, went to Yale, very traditionally trained, and I was very skeptical about these kinds of things like past lives. I didn't believe in it. I wasn't really exposed to it. I didn't think about it much. And then I had gone through the academic route, and I was chairman of psychiatry at Mount Sinai Medical Center in Miami Beach and professor of psychiatry at the University of Miami School of Medicine. I had a patient, a woman who was suffering from pretty severe phobias, panic attacks, depression, nightmares. And one of her fears was the fear of gagging or choking. So she couldn't take any medication. Normally, I would have used that to treat her symptoms. And so we used traditional psychotherapy, not making too much progress. And I wanted to use hypnosis, which is merely a form of focusing the concentration, but it does help the memory.
Right.
And she had some memory gaps in her childhood, so we used the hypnosis, and she had some qualms about it at first, but overcame those. And focusing then on her childhood, we did find some traumas, but her symptoms remained severe. So when she was in for one of her sessions, after not making much progress with hypnosis and memory work in her childhood, I told her to go back to the time when her symptoms first began. I let her choose. And she went back several thousand years into an ancient Near Eastern lifetime, although she didn't believe in reincarnation or past lives, and I did not either. But this is what she was describing to me with a great deal of emotion, very vivid, lots of details, very visual. All of her senses were engaged. And she drowned in that ancient lifetime. I didn't know if it was fantasy or imagination or metaphor or symbol or a combination of all.
And it probably didn't matter because in her mind it happened. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. And oddly enough, her symptoms began to disappear almost immediately, just having this memory. For example, she had a lifelong fear of water, of drowning, of deep water. And it probably came from that memory, from that experience. Although I didn't even know that at the time. And that disappeared, and her phobia started to disappear as she would remember other lifetimes, and her fears diminished. And eventually she was cured without, in her case, having to take any medicines. That was the beginning for me.
That was pretty dramatic. So when you saw this happen, what were you thinking? What was going through your mind?
Well, again, being very psychoanalytically trained and traditionally trained, I was thinking metaphor or symbol or imagination, but it didn't fit. I had already treated her for over a year traditionally. She didn't have delusions or hallucinations, or she wasn't abusing any substances. She was not psychotic. She's not borderline, not bipolar. It didn't fit. And then when her symptoms began to resolve just by having these memories, and that doesn't fit for fantasy or imagination, because imagination does not cure such chronic, lifelong symptoms. Some of those she had all of her life, like the fear of gagging, fear of water, and those just disappeared. Her depression got better, her fears got better, her panic attacks disappeared. And so for me, the drama, the importance of clearing up her symptoms, that became paramount. So whatever it was, I was going to study it more and more intensely because it was helping to cure illness. And for a physician, that's very important.
When you started studying these, were you, even before this episode, this first episode that got you interested in it, were you a believer in it or were you a skeptic?
I was very much a skeptic. I didn't believe in it at all. And, you know, training in psychiatry with studying Freud and Jung, it becomes its own belief system. And that's what I really followed. I was pretty much a conservative psychiatrist. And she didn't believe in it, a Catholic woman from New England. She wasn't in her background either. And yet she had these experiences, and I was watching it, witnessing it, watching her get better. Also, she was coming up with historical facts and details that she had never studied, never learned. And she started telling me very secret, private things about myself, which she could not have looked up, because this was happening around 1980. This was the beginning for me. So about 33 years ago, before the internet, and she was telling me when she died in one of these Middle Ages lifetimes and floated above her body, replicating the near-death experience work of Raymond Moody and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and others, although she had never heard of these people. She told me there were two people there in that space in between lifetimes to see me, my father and my son. And as I said, she didn't know anything about me. I don't even have diplomas in my office, because one theory of psychotherapy is you don't want the patient to know about you. You want them to project their thoughts and feelings and ideas into the therapeutic arena. So not even diplomas hanging, no place to look this up. And she, my father had died a year before she began her therapy. My first child, a son, had died 10 years earlier as an infant of a very rare congenital heart disease. And she was telling me medical details of that heart disease, of my son, of my father's death and the medical details, nicknames, other private details that nobody knew. Neither of them even had an obituary. There's no place to look it up. And so that was the epiphany for me, I think, watching her get better, watching the symptoms resolve, her coming up with facts and details that she had never learned, and then knowing these very private details about my father and my son. That was too much, even for a skeptical mind like mine.
Yeah, that would do it, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Now, did you have issues with after-death experiences? Did you have issues with even believing that, you know, there was another side after death? Besides reincarnation and other past life issues.
Sure. That I wasn't sure about. I think probably the best term to describe my spiritual views was agnostic. I just didn't know. And I didn't spend much time thinking about those things either. I was young at that time. I was in my late 30s and not really knowing or being able to prove in the scientific way what happens after death. And so I was aware of Raymond Moody and the near-death experience, but I don't know whether I really believed that or accepted it completely. Just kind of open-minded skepticism. But then when Catherine, the woman that I described in Many Lives, Many Masters, my first book, and this is the one we're talking about, when she described about my father and my son, when her symptoms began disappearing, when she knew these historical facts and details, it was the opening for me of a whole new psycho-spiritual system, life after death, the other side, different dimensions, because she would talk about those things when she was in these deeper states. When she died in one of these past lives, she would float above, find a light, describe the dimensions, what happens there, and that just seemed to be, for me, somewhat more persuasive now, because she knew about my father and my son. And I remember thinking, if she's right about these things, about my father, about my son, could she be right about these other things, past lives, life after death, the survival of the soul after the death of the physical body, all of these other things that I had not spent much time really contemplating, but now are becoming very important in my life.
Brian, in your new work, miracles happen, of course, and we know they do. Of course, the subtitle is The Transformational Healing Power of Past Life Memories. Let's talk about that. I want to get into miracles with you tonight a lot, but let's talk about how people in their past lives can utilize that to make their current life a little better.
Yes, it really is. We call them miracles because they're so different from what so many people believe life is, that they're just the physical body and the brain. And we were finding, me and all the other therapists doing this work, and Amy, my daughter, who's also a therapist, a social worker, so when she does this work, finding the same things, that people would know what happened after they died, that they would float above, often having reunions with loved ones, also getting rid of symptoms, healing physically and emotionally and spiritually and in all of these other ways, becoming very intuitive, psychic. It would change them. They would start to lose their fear of death and dying. They wouldn't grieve so much. And these were, to us, miracles because, wow, there's a whole hidden world out there, a world that many people are not familiar with, although many of the people who listen to your show, to Coast over these years, are more familiar than the average person.
True.
And yet, you know, for the, I'll call it the mainstream person, the person who really hasn't been made aware of through your show, through reading books or in other ways, it's really miraculous to see symptoms disappearing just because you remember a past life trauma, to understand that you've been connected to your grandparents and all the other significant people in your life in past lives. And so you're always being reunited, whether it's in a future life, it's on the other side, and it changes the whole way that people can view death and dying and grief and grieving. So to us, these were miracles, whether it's a physical healing, an emotional healing, getting rid of an illness. It can be a simple thing like healing an infected tetanus shot just with your mind, not with using antibiotics, and something like that, or a major miracle like a serious illness that just disappears because people have these memories and the memories are curative.
Why is it, Brian, that when people are under extreme stress or anxiety that they seem to get sicker?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is that stress is so dangerous because one of the things it does is depress the immune system. The whole process by which the body protects itself, by which it wards off illness and disease, fights infections, and stress, there's no question, it depresses the functions of the immune system. So that's a very dangerous condition. And you see people under chronic stress developing serious illnesses and cancer too, because the immune system is what fights these illnesses. And then, of course, stress causes the body to secrete chemicals and hormones that can be damaging to the body, that cause hypertension and heart disease, narrowing of the blood vessels, atherosclerosis, and again, a whole panoply of illnesses and diseases. So whatever reduces stress, whatever minimizes it, is healthy for the body. And anything that increases stress over a longer period of time, obviously stress over a very short period of time is not so dangerous. That's how our bodies are designed. You have the fight or flight reaction. You are almost in an accident. You secrete adrenaline. It focuses your concentration, and that's okay. But if stress goes on every day in your life, even when you're not in a life or death situation, that's when it gets dangerous, when it depresses the immune system and causes the secretion of all of these chemicals and hormones. And that's why it's so dangerous, George.
Do you have to remember the past life in order to heal?
No, not at all. Some people remember traumas in childhood or in the current life. Some people, it's just going into these deeper states, these states of relaxation that And I use those deeper states of relaxed, focused concentration to help the memory. But just being in that state, that gets rid of stress. That reduces stress. So that by itself is very healthy. Now, when you have a memory, that's even more powerful. Let's just say, for example, you have a fear of heights, and you then remember in one of these deeper states being thrown off a castle wall in the 12th century, or falling off a cliff or a mountain or something like that, or down a ravine. And when you in a past life, and when you remember that, then those symptoms disappear. That phobia of heights will disappear because you know that it comes from a past life. It's not something that's going to happen in the future. And so it's even more powerful because you're relaxing, you're getting rid of the stress reaction, and you're remembering the traumatic origins of the symptoms.
Give us, if you can, another example before the break, something that totally convinced you.
Well, one of the examples, a radiologist at Mount Sinai came in to see me suffering from severe back pain. A simple example, this is how it works, though. And he had been to orthopedic surgeons and others without any real success. The back pain was severe. He had to take a medicine for the pain, which he did not like taking because it made him tired and his thinking a little fuzzy. And he was able to remember a lifetime when he was a soldier in a Middle Ages battle, and he's seeing the battlefield. All of his senses are engaged. He's speared in the back in that battle. That's how he died, right in the spot where his back pain is most severe in the current life. And since that time, his back pain disappeared. It's not there. And he's not taking any medicines. It's been years now, functioning well, no surgeries, just by remembering the traumatic origins of that symptom. Another patient, a woman of mine, a professor of physics, very intelligent woman, back pain from severe illness, cancer, mm-hmm. radiation, and in the past life, she was kicked in the back by Roman soldiers 2,000 years ago in Jerusalem. She was a man. It broke her back. When she remembered that, not only did the back pain from the cancer treatment disappear, but she started to regenerate tissues and bones.
Which is unheard of.
Unheard of, but documented in her case by x-rays and radiologic evidence. So very, very interesting how powerful this can be as a healing technique.
What is it about these past lives and these tragedies that occurred that carry on to the current life?
It seems that the symptoms come from these tragedies or traumas. A lot of people who just remember kind of more placid lifetimes or tranquil lifetimes, they may not have that symptom. But those people that I see more of, because being a psychiatrist, I see people with symptoms, they'll come in with symptoms, and those tend to come from these traumas. It's not difficult, painful, traumatic to remember them. It's just like remembering a childhood incident. But when you do remember these traumas, then the symptoms disappear. So when I see people with symptoms, it's often related to traumas. But when I see people who are just merely curious about their past lives, we sometimes call them past life tourists.
We're going to talk more with you, Dr. Brian Weiss, his work, Miracles Happen, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Dr. Brian Weiss with us as we talk about their latest work, Miracles Happen. Later on, we'll take phone calls, questions for him. Then later on in the show, I want your miracle stories, of course. Can everybody be hypnotized, Brian? I don't think so, right?
No, not everybody. It's a form of concentration. So some people just are not able to concentrate. Clearly, people with dementia, Alzheimer's, they can't do it. It's a concentration thing. People who are intoxicated or impaired that way cannot do it. Some people with mental problems in terms of mental illness, difficulty concentrating, have difficulty. But about 85% of people can be. So that's most people.
The people who are going through these stages of past lives, reincarnation, Do you document it based on faith, or is there something else physical there?
Well, my approach has always been the clinical, coming from medicine, coming from psychiatry. So when we put people into past life regressions, going backwards in time, and then they come up with the memories, we try to look at it at two different levels. One, the level of healing, people getting rid of symptoms, people curing emotional or physical maladies. And the other level is that of validation, where maybe they can track down historical facts or details that they start talking about, identifying information. Sometimes people will read a dog tag number from around their necks from World War II or concentration camp number from their arms and be able to track the people that they were. A small percentage of people can speak foreign languages that they've never learned or studied. That's called xenoglossy. It's spelled X-E-N-O, xenoglossy, speaking foreign languages you never studied. So if I have someone under hypnosis speaking medieval German and they never learned German, that's a kind of proof or evidential about the past life. Where is that coming from? So we document it that way. Now, you don't have to believe in reincarnation to have these memories. A lot of people that I see come because they're afflicted by their symptoms or their illnesses, maybe a phobia that's paralyzing their life, and they want to be better. So they say, well, I'm going to try it anyway, even though I don't believe in it. If it helps me, great. And then when they have the experiences, they start believing in it because the experiences can be very clear and very powerful.
Some people, those who are very religious, I don't want to go there necessarily, but they tend to think that reincarnation or past life regression is almost a sin. How come?
Well, there's a whole history of reincarnation or past life belief systems in the different religions. And many people don't even understand the history of their own religions. And that's normal. It happens. They're told something when they're two or three or four. It may be completely wrong. But just because they learned it when they were very young, they think that it's true. And it may not be. You can say, well, I learned that the earth was flat when I was 3 years old, so that must be true. That's what I was taught. But it doesn't mean that it's true at all. So they're not aware that in many of the great religions, belief in reincarnation was present for centuries before it was taken out for political reasons, usually, or that kind of thing. And it was certainly in the Jewish religion for many, many centuries, many centuries, and still is in the very Orthodox or Hasidic. Reincarnation belief was in Christianity for several hundred years after Jesus.
Oh,
it was acceptable. It wasn't taken out until basically the 5th century, 6th century, for good. And yet, belief in reincarnation has been in Christianity over all these centuries, and today most of the world does believe in it. If you were born as a Hindu or a Buddhist, you would believe in reincarnation. So that's a billion people in India and another half billion people in China who believe in reincarnation, just because they were born into that culture, and there the belief is accepted. So people get so vehement about what they were taught when they were children, but it really pays to do some research and investigation into your own traditions. And I tell people, well, try it for yourself, because keeping an open mind is really the important part of this all. An open mind means that you're willing to look at new data to evaluate it. And if your mind is closed, then you cannot learn anything new, because your mind is closed. You'll reject it. And that's a very narrow and unscientific approach. Science is really keeping an open mind and testing different hypotheses and theorems. And that's what I would recommend to people. But ever since I started doing this work, I've run into closed-minded people, not just in religions, but also in the medical establishment. I was facing a great deal of criticism and even censure movements from the local psychiatric society in Miami.
Really?
Yeah, when I started doing this work, and word got out, and my book, the first book, came out, and there was a censure movement. It didn't get anywhere because I was, I had been here for some years already, had been teaching medical students and psychiatry residents. So a lot of my students protected me, defended me, and it didn't get anywhere. But still, you know, this was in the late 1980s, to be brought up on a censure movement just for writing about my observations that done in a very scientific way, that was very backwards. And of course, I was glad it didn't get anywhere, because this is observation and validation, and that's the scientific method. But so people are so powerfully opposed sometimes to the different, the new, that they're unable to get past their closed-mindedness.
And that's disappointing, isn't it?
It is. It is. Because they can be very intelligent people, and yet, in some ways, and yet very unintelligent and unsophisticated in other ways. So, I mean, it sometimes is shocking to me. I remember being on a television show years ago, and it was a cable CNBC show, something like that. And I go on to talk about past life regression and therapy, and the skeptic that they brought in to sort of debate me with it was Carl Sagan, the astronomer.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so I'm there, and I admire him. I mean, his work, the movie with Jodie Foster, loved that. But he was very skeptical about certain things. He was in a skeptic society. And I don't know what he thought he was coming to debate, but we were debating a clinical treatment, past life regression. So we're talking about these things, and he really didn't know much about therapy. And I'm talking about my patients and how they're improving and getting rid of symptoms and coming up with this and speaking foreign languages and knowing historical facts and details, sometimes finding their children from a past life. And he's supposed to be the skeptic, and he's really not making any sense. So finally I say to him, Carl, how are your patients doing? And he said, well, I'm an astronomer. I don't have any patients. And I said, I know. That's why you shouldn't be here discussing this. And if you want to be a skeptic, remember what a skeptic really is in the Greek sense of the word. A skeptic is someone who offers alternative explanations for phenomena, like could it be this or could it be that? If not past lives, is it tapping into the collective unconscious that Carl Jung wrote about, or the Akashic records? Could it be these other things? Could it just be that we know everything? And I was reminding him what a scientist does and thinks, and how an open-minded skeptic should be, not rejecting something that they don't know anything about, but keeping an open mind and asking intelligent questions and offering, as I mentioned, alternative possibilities. And then we got into a really good discussion, because I reminded him of the role of a good skeptic. And then he was asking really good questions, because he was a very intelligent man. But again, sometimes you find, I'm just shocked that someone like him would have been so closed-minded.
Why do we reincarnate? When I was a kid, I used to think it was to reach the heavenly state, to get more perfect all the time. You keep coming back, you try to get perfect.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that's what it is. We reincarnate because we have to learn our lessons to become perfect, to become what the Eastern people call realized or transcendent or enlightened. And it takes more than one lifetime to learn all these lessons. It's too complicated. We have to learn about compassion and nonviolence and kindness and other aspects of spirituality, about patience, about all of these things that can take lifetimes and lifetimes to learn. And then sometimes, you know, a child will be born, have an illness, die very young. When do they have the opportunity to learn these lessons? So they have to come back. We all come back. And it is to become perfect, to become a graduate, so we don't have to come back here anymore. Then we can just stay on the other side, help from the other side, because we're connected, I think, with all other beings It's a kind of an energy thing. And we help them to graduate too. But I think you're absolutely right. As a child, as children often do, you realize the overall bigger picture.
Can you split a soul where it can be in two bodies?
I think so, yes. Because souls, when we talk about souls, and by that I mean that part of us that doesn't die when the physical body dies, the consciousness that goes on after the death of the physical body, we shouldn't limit a soul by putting or projecting limitations on it. So I think that answers a question, George, that people often are perplexed by and ask me, how can it be that the numbers don't fit, that perhaps there are more bodies on the earth than ever before? Where the population is so large, where do the souls come from then? And the two explanations that come up most frequently in my research, one is what you just mentioned. Souls can split and have simultaneous experiences because eventually it's just all one energy. And the other is that this is not the only place where souls exist, the earth, that souls can exist in many, many other dimensions, physical dimensions, non-physical dimensions. So earth is just one of many, many schools, just one tiny little place, the earth. And so souls can be attracted here from many other places, other galaxies, other universes, non-physical dimensions, and that it also explains the population question.
A lot of people want to know about animals, Brian, if animals have souls.
I think so. We have an entire chapter in Miracles Happen about animals, an animal reincarnation, and animal souls. So it's really answered in great depth there. It's about, yes, is basically the short answer, although I'm not sure that the souls of animals are as differentiated as people, but nevertheless, they have souls too. All beings have souls, and animals can come back. And you frequently see the same soul, animal, coming back to the same owner, family, constellation, because an animal's lifetime, for example, a cat or a dog, may be shorter than the human lifetime.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, and so a dog can die, for example, and come back to the same family in a different body as a dog and be reunited. And we see that with people. We see it with dogs, with cats, with animals, horses. All animals have souls also and can reincarnate.
And let me ask you this. With the animals that come back, and you say sometimes they can enter other animals, do they ever enter a human? I mean, does an animal soul ever become a human?
Well, that probably yes, but I don't know how often that happens. It is certainly in Eastern traditions they talk about that. We've all had lifetimes in different forms. I think, though, that animals can, and it seems like a progression, although sometimes it seems that humans may not be the highest form, although we probably are, even though we don't act that way. But I think that once you're a human, you stay a human. I know the Eastern religions speak differently about it, but I think that we stay as humans when we reach that level. And we may come back here. That's kind of the punishment, the karma, whatever you want to call it. We still have lessons to learn. That's what it means. But I don't think we go back into animal bodies, or I should say more accurately that I don't find that. And it could be simply that we don't remember lifetimes as animals.
Has anybody under hypnotherapy ever said that they were?
They have, but it's rare. And then you wonder, well, is it metaphor? Is it symbol? Is it actual memory? Hard to prove that one because you can't really validate it. But the answer is yes, but not commonly.
Brian, for people who want to get the book Miracles Happen, available everywhere, it's published by Harper One. It's a great read with Amy. Did she have fun doing this?
Yeah, we had great fun. Amy, my daughter, she's a wonderful writer, also a therapist. So she helped enormously. We collected some of our most astounding and best stories and cases of people who had been attending our workshops and our patients, and we put them into this book, and I commented on each one of them because it's important to understand what's going on. But these represent some of the most interesting cases. And so it was great fun working with her. It was such a joy. We would sit there and, like, complete each other's thoughts.
That's great.
It was great.
When you work in tandem like that, that's very special, isn't it?
Very special.
Free will. They say we have it. Do we really?
It's a complicated thing. You know, it seems that we do, but it may be at a higher level. Everything is known by the wisdom, the intelligence of that level. But we certainly seem to have free will here, but we also have destiny. And we know destiny points occur, like meeting a certain person that's going to influence your life. That's destiny. But what you decide after you meet that person, are you going to work with them, marry them, reject them? Those are the free will parts. So I think we do have free will, but at some level, maybe there's a higher wisdom that already knows the decision we're going to make.
Maybe they do. And can you, as you look into the past with regression, have you ever looked into the future?
Yes, it's a fascinating area, a whole big area. I wrote a book, Same Soul, Many Bodies, about doing future progressions, going into the future. We call regressions going into the past, progressions going into the future, because there really is no time. There is no time. On the earth, there's time, but beyond that, no time. And probably or possibly these lifetimes are going on in parallel.
All right, stay with us, Brian. We're coming back for more with you on Coast to Coast AM.